I'm Christopher Lydon with the poet Ron Slate, aspiring to the Wallace Stevens line of New England corporate burgers who write wonderfully. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University in a poetry series we call Whose Words These Are. On the way to the Massachusetts Poetry Festival in October, we're looking around and asking, where is poetry in this country, in this age, this neighborhood? I met Ron Slate years ago when he did high-tech business strategy, and then again in his first book of poetry at age 55. I keep an eye on his website On the Seawall and on his close reading commentaries on literary fiction and other poets. This is a man of the world and of the polished, reflective word. We met this time at the Grolier Poetry Bookshop in Harvard Square. Ron Slate, get us started with a poem or a poet that got you started. When you think of the touchstones of your own reading and writing.
Sure. Well, when I think back, I'm in my late teens and I'm an undergraduate, and I was taking a Wallace Stevens seminar. Most of Wallace Stevens went right over my head at that point. But the professor would have the campus poets, the teaching poets, come into the classroom to read their favorite Wallace Stevens poem. And one day, Jim Tate came in, and his poem was The Man on the Dump, which is one of Stevens's most humorous poems, except he didn't read it. He recited it. He looked out to the class, and he recited it. And I said to myself, that's what I want to do. You know, I want to be able to be with people and to use this kind of language to get them agitated. And Wallace Stevens, for me, is my touchstone poet.
Read us a poem that you'd take to a desert island if you could only take three.
Okay. I would take this poem by Louise Glick. I think it's from the mid-80s. It's a beautiful narrative. It's called Celestial Music. I have a friend who still believes in heaven. Not a stupid person, yet with all she knows, she literally talks to God. She thinks someone listens in heaven. On earth, she's unusually competent, brave too, able to face unpleasantness. We found a caterpillar dying in the dirt, greedy ants crawling over it. I'm always moved by disaster, always eager to oppose vitality, but timid also, quick to shut my eyes. Whereas my friend was able to watch, to let events play out according to nature. For my sake, she intervened, brushing a few ants off the torn thing and set it down across the road. My friend says, I shut my eyes to God, that nothing else explains my aversion to reality. She says, I'm like the child who buries her head in the pillow so as not to see, the child who tells herself that light causes sadness. My friend is like the mother, patient, urging me to wake up an adult like herself, a courageous person. In my dreams, my friend reproaches me. We're walking on the same road, except it's winter now. She's telling me that when you love the world, you hear celestial music. Look up, she says. When I look up, nothing. Only clouds, snow, a white business in the trees, like brides leaping to a great height. Then I'm afraid for her. I see her caught in a net deliberately cast over the earth. In reality, we sit by the side of the road, watching the sunset. From time to time, the silence pierced by a bird call. It's this moment we're trying to explain, the fact that we're at ease with death, with solitude. My friend draws a circle in the dirt. Inside, the caterpillar doesn't move. She's always trying to make something whole, something beautiful, an image capable of life apart from her. We're very quiet. It's peaceful sitting here, not speaking. Composition fixed, the road turning suddenly dark, the air going cool, here and there the rocks shining and glittering. It's this stillness we both love, Love of form is a love of endings.
So much life in that poem, from the caterpillar to the celestial.
It is. It's filled with, and it has the one essential thing that I look for in a poem. I know you're interested in that that question, Chris, which is conflict. Hmm. I'm not really interested in spiritual uplift or the necessity of the beautiful, although this poem is beautiful. Nor do my emotions have to be fed, although I find this poem emotional in its way. But the reason I really like it is that there's an embedded, unresolved conflict.
Mm. I love that context you said of your young self sort of zeroing in on Stevens. But go even beyond, Ron. You're such a reader and critic. Locate yourself in this moment, your community, in that great chain of poetic being all the way back.
Yeah. Well, I think, first of all, that I'm somewhat old-fashioned in light of a lot of the things that are going on now in American poetry. It's become distasteful for some poets to think of having to make a statement in a poem. There is this thing coming out of the academy that consists of a sort of mistrust of language because the great powers around us, the great political powers, grab the language and determine its value. So if you can write a poem that resists making a statement, that in itself is a kind of subtle political act. But I think that I'm prone to making statements.
How would you describe the state of the art at this moment in time? I'm thinking in the United States in 2009, where are we at in poetry?
I think poetry right now, and I see this in the work of a lot of young poets, is very much affected by pop culture.
Hmm.
And by the movies. There are poets today who are who have found a model to behave in poetry like Quentin Tarantino does in his movies. Hmm. Kind of gratuitous violence of the language, violence of the imagery. I'm a reader for one of the major competitions, first book competitions, or at least have been for the last 4 years. And so I read about 125 manuscripts during a couple of weeks at the beginning of December. And I get a sense of what is coming out of the workshops. And it is so various that, in fact, it is difficult to pin down particular strains. And I think that's the answer to the question. Just as everything else in the world, from toothpaste to commodities, and is niched in magazines, now poetry is very niched. And depending on what workshop you come out of and who your mentor is and who you choose to imitate and what your particular identity politics are, you're going to write a certain kind of poetry.
Ron Slate, give us some of your own work. And the context you want us to hear it in.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm 59 years old. I published my first book at age 55, which is not so uncommon. In fact, Wallace Stevens published his first book in his mid-40s. But when you are writing in your 50s, what I find that myself doing is reflecting a lot. And also because I don't feel that there's a lot at stake for me as far as having to establish a voice. Do you know what I mean? I think that there's pressure on a younger poet to establish your signature and establish your voice, to create your brand. And I don't feel any pressure to do that at all. So my books, the way I think of them, they're sort of like smorgasbords. They're whatever I feel like trying out. Although some people may not see great variety there. But whatever I feel like trying out, I just do. And my first book is quite various. So there are some poems that shamelessly cling to my memory, just borrow from memory, something that already exists. And then there are other poems that are persona poems that are spoken in the voices of other people that appeal to me for an entirely different reason. So I have found that when people comment on my book, they tend to gravitate towards what they think are the biographical poems, because those are the easiest ones to explain by way of the backstory.
Give us some of both.
Okay, well,
please.
I think that I'll read a poem called Coconut Grove, which is in The Great Wave. It's a book that Houghton Mifflin published in April of this year.
Coconut Grove is in the nightclub fire or something else?
That's right. My grandmother and her sister died in the fire. Mm. And it is the second worst catastrophe by fire in the history of the United States. 492 people died, most by smoke inhalation within a few minutes, in Boston, on what is now the grounds location of the Radisson Hotel.
After a big football game, as I remember.
After the BC Holy Cross game. And I wrote a poem about the Coconut Grove fire in the 1970s. It was published in a magazine. And then I should mention that I stopped writing poetry for almost 20 years, in the 80s and the 90s. And when it started up again, for what reason I don't know, around 2001, I felt that I had to take this up again, that there were still... The material had a lot of legs for me, let's put it that way. And there was something that I wanted to say about it that that I hadn't said the first time. So, you know, what I get in a lot of poetry, reading a lot of poetry today that is based on memory, based on anecdote, I get an uncomfortable feeling because autobiographical poems that just sort of leech off memory to me tend to fail because they don't bring an additional... anxiety or an additional unresolved element to the poem, right? And in my first version of the Coconut Grove, as I dug it up out of the archives up in my attic, I saw that essentially what I had done was I just reeled off the facts, which are horrific, you know, and which are engrossing in and of themselves. They make a great poem, but as far as the material itself, but that's not enough. So I just went back to it and hoped that in the writing of something else would come out. And so this poem is called Coconut Grove. My life began with the fire, glimmering in the birth waters. Beyond my bedroom wall, voices murmured a memory. My father's mother died with her sister in the ladies' room. He said, if she had escaped to Shawmut Street, been saved, nothing would be the way it is. How is it? Drifted over my route to school. I stared at a wire service photo, fixed with brutal light, a fire hose snaking through soaked debris, faces slack with shock, bodies laid out on the sidewalk. How compelling for a family to have such a story to relate. Nothing would be the way it is. To speak of a desirable world, the listening boy leaning in. November in Boston, women collapsed, waiting for their coats. The ceiling's satinette billows crackled and melted and were drawn into their throats. A shoe wedged in the revolving door. A face pressed against glass. The fireball, bright orange, or bluish with a yellow cast, or a blistering white. The nightclub burned in minutes in 1942 with a sibilant exhalation. My grandfather, sworn in, testified, but a single night evades judgment, bloated with unassignable blame. Corrosive worm of remembrance, a lure of the lurid past, the nozzle's snout regressing down the smoldering street. Adoring the damaged world, we abused it. We refused to let the sea wind clear the smoke. So now it's time to decide how to move within spaces on the sites of catastrophe. How to regard the atria and the lobbies, even as the alarms sound, evacuations rehearsed, the streets filling with imaginary survivors. Just as the boy, surviving boyhood, said, so that's how it is, just before sleep settled on him like asbestos.
Don't we hear that as a 9/11 poem?
Yeah, it is, and it actually was written in response to a beautiful poem by Adam Zagajewski, which appeared on the back page of The New Yorker immediately after the catastrophe down there, in which he pleaded with the reader to adore the damaged world. He was pleading with us not to get swept up in the grief which would lead to the nationalism that would lead to other things. It's almost as if, of course, he, coming from Poland and understanding what the basic human impulses are when something like this happens, was warning us to adore the damaged world. And oddly enough, in my family, we adored it so much that it became such a part of the family's personality that it caused a lot of issues. And the pretense of the poem is that the boy took the brunt of the whole thing.
Ron Slate, you know so much about technology and the political world. Give us a poem that reflects some of those things, the modernity.
Yeah, okay.
Of Ron Slate.
Yeah. In this book, I reflected back on my years in business. There isn't a lot of technology per se. I mean, I'm not a technologist. What I did in business was I took basic writing skills and became a speechwriter and then got into communications, meaning advertising and public relations. And then the internet came and I got into that. I don't know a lot about technology. The way I felt about it was that if I could understand the things I was saying about technology, then anybody could. If you could understand what I was writing about technology, then you could understand all there is to know, all that really matters.
You've thought a lot about its effects. Don't be too modest here.
I have thought a lot about its effects, and I basically see technology as a neutral thing, and it really all depends how it's applied. There's a poem in here called, in the Great Wave, called Reunion, which is, the frame of the poem is that a bunch of people who worked together get together for drinks and to reflect back on the old times, which is, in fact, what I still do with some of my friends from this Fortune 500 company where I worked. We still get together a couple of times a year and tell the stories. So this poem is called Reunion. I attended the reunion, talk brisk but diluted by time. A colleague raised his glass to praise me. His legacy here is legendary. Not one of us knows what I was like. News of former colleagues, vanished friends. This one was commended, that one was broken by onerous obligations, and she is dissatisfied but no longer ill. Looking down six stories, I saw a woman approaching the office tower across the avenue, her right arm swinging, the other slightly bent at the elbow, in motion yet not released, suggesting all that remains to be done. Next time I looked out the window, darkness had taken the city below. There was the time in Sydney, in Barcelona, Sao Paulo, and Rome. Apparently, everywhere I went, I said and did remarkable things. Aloft above cities, one encountered women with no taste for nonsense. I told a lady in Amsterdam I was an astronaut. She said, "You're too small." I said, "This is an advantage in a capsule." Crude forsakings of faces and cities. The memory of my farewells makes me sad. Their wordplay, so much charm, but not much else. Yet I lived in a larger world. My worries, paltry and ridiculous, disappeared in dialogue, and then I was alone and pleasantly spent. Of our buildings, corridors, and movable walls, what I recall is a slender wrist and hand reaching for a slice of toast sliding down the exit ramp of the toaster. The cafeteria, a place of suspensions, surprising postures, and revelations. I was adept at envisioning a world of invention and speed, then swiftly abandoning it for another, until it seemed no great matter to enter the world, to think you are entering, earning, providing. At the revolving door of the office tower, she paused. An extraordinary act, a woman stopping cold like that, making me a stranger to our past.
Can I ask you two personal sort of questions? One is how a guy becomes a poet again in his 50s, and what Louise Glick, one of your models, had to do with it. She was by then poet laureate, I think, and a famous poet, and she brought you back. She encouraged you.
Well, I as I said before, I don't really know what precipitated, what triggered the ability to think through language again, to bring it back, because I had really shut down completely. You know, it's now I think about lines and words all day long. I jot things down all day long, and it seems strange to me when I look back, and I can't figure out why. And I have reason to mistrust my memory too. So I have all kinds of explanations, most of which conflicted with each other as to why I did not write. But when it started, I found all of a sudden that I had enough poems to make a manuscript, and a friend of mine, Floyd Skloot, the poet and an essayist, suggested that I try to shape that into a book manuscript. I had enough work for a book manuscript. And so, you know, that led to the work coming to the attention of Louise, and I worked with her for a couple of years before the first book came out. And she's, I'd pay good money to sit in her workshops at Yale or BU, because I did not know how to revise until I sat down and worked with her. She's a very sharp teacher, great critic, and seemed to know exactly what it is that I was trying to do. So it worked out great.
The other question is, what does it say about you and your work that your daughter is new in the cast of Saturday Night Live, doing a kind of fantasy that you'd always imagined?
Yeah, right. I do like to tell a joke, but Jenny is a mimic. And actually, you know, when I see a poem I like, I know that you're supposed to just do everything you can to not glom onto the model and the work of another person. But if I see something that really provokes me, I can't deny that it sticks in my head. In 2001, I was sitting in my office at EMC, and I knew I was going to be leaving the company that year sometime. And I opened the Wall Street Journal to the arts page. It was a great arts page in the journal. And there was a poem by Frederick Seidel. And I read the poem, and I said, this sounds familiar. And I realized, this sounds like me. there's something about this that it sounds like me. His work actually is quite different than mine. But there are some things in my first book that sound like Frederick Seidel. I have to admit, they just do. They're very glib. They're elusive. They jump around the page. They're kind of cynical. That's Frederick Seidel. But that's what got me going. I think when I actually heard an echo of something that sounded like me talking. So I have a different view about, I'm grateful, you know, to having heard that. But that's the closest I can come to a starting point for having begun again. Those poems I read by Seidel.
I want to give you what we call the Proust in the Grotty Bookshop questionnaire, as you will, as briefly as you can. Who's your ideal artist in some other sphere?
I've been writing about photography on my website. Robert Frank, and before him Walker Evans, but especially Robert Frank, mainly because with Walker Evans that you have that sense of this pure vision of humanity and the images themselves are very rich, and the prints themselves are beautiful. But with Frank, you get that, but you also get the energy of his eye. So when he shoots the city, not only is it in motion, but it seems to be going in a certain direction. He seems to know where it's headed. Yeah.
Any others in jazz, in basketball, in sculpture?
There is a musician. I'm a drummer who always wanted to be a piano player. And I just heard some music by Astor Piazzolla, who created the new tango music. He took tango music, he took the kind of Rococo romantic Brazilian music, and he turned it into something simple and passionate and melodic, and his music is wonderful. And I also think he took something and made something new. He created a whole genre, and his songs are wonderful. And another guy I like is Ennio Morricone, who writes music for the movies.
What's the talent that you most admire and don't have, would love to have?
I wish I could swim. I'm not very buoyant. As I said, I'm a drummer who always wanted to be a piano player. There's no doubt about that. I wish I could do that. I have taken lessons. I can read music a little bit, but I just never stuck to it. That's one thing.
What's the key note of your personality as a poet, do you think?
I would say nervous uncertainty. Yeah.
What's the quality you love in a poem?
Well, I mentioned that before with celestial music, which is this feeling of unresolved conflict. That there's a clash of forces that is becoming apparent as you move through the poem, and when you get to the end of the poem, you're kind of vibrating with that sense of the unfinished business.
Mm-hmm.
The poem keeps on going because the thought keeps on going. There isn't closure, and yet formally the poem ends. In fact, I think the last word of that poem is endings. The love of form is a love of endings. You have to be pretty daring to end a poem with a line like that. You have to really have a lot of guts, I think.
What's your motto?
We do what we want. Because often we say, oh, I wish I hadn't done that. Or I wish I could do this. Or I wish I could swim. But the fact is that I don't want to dive into the water. And that's why I don't swim. You know, and so there's we do what we want. It seems to me to explain everything, and it gets us out of having to feel that we live on a higher moral plane, because we're always critiquing ourselves and critiquing other people. But we all end up doing the thing that we want to do, even when we say we didn't want to do it, because we did it for a reason. It's because we want to do it.
Especially in the run-up to this poetry festival in Lowell. I'm asking everybody to make the New England connection with the ancestors Thoreau and Emerson and Dickinson and Stevens. What does that tradition of poetry mean to you today?
I went to school in Western Massachusetts, and one of the poets I loved was Robert Francis, who lived in Amherst. And I'll quote him in a second, but I think of these people who go around defending poetry or promoting poetry, which I think is a wonderful thing to do. But they do it as if, our lives will just be rotten if we don't read poetry. You know, that we must save poetry. We must save poetry from the illiterates. And Robert Francis used to say, it's not my job to save poetry. It's poetry's job to save me. and actually, poetry has a very economical way of saving me, of saving us. But I think the New England tradition is one of individualism. It's not one of group ethos. It's Robert Frost saying, when you bring your lame horse to market, you should get as much as you can for it. And if the sucker buys it, you told him it was lame.
Self-reliance, so to speak, in the old tradition.
There you go.
Ron Slate, your website, On the Seawall, is a joy, and it's a great pleasure to hear you read today.
It's been great, Chris. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Ron Slate, whose new book of poems is The Great Wave. Our Brown University interns Ben Mandelkern and Hannah Olson helped produce the talk and the podcast. Thanks to the Grolier Bookshop and the Massachusetts Poetry Festival for helping gather up the players. And thanks to listeners who post the poems of your pen, your heart, your word processor, your memory at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.